Oh, good to have your company. My name's Simon Smart. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're going to be talking today about a topic that might be a little bit odd on the radio, silence. And with me today to talk about that is Justine Toe. Hi, Justine.
Hey, Simon. How's it going?
Good. Now, silence, awkward or otherwise, we're going to talk about it today. Acoustic ecologist, didn't know there was such a thing until recently, but Gordon Hempton is one of these people, and he collects natural sounds. And he says that silence is an endangered species. He's talking about the end of natural silence, which is increasingly under threat as we kind of build further and further into the natural world. And his comments sort of apply, I'd imagine, too, to a technologically wired, sort of always connected world that we're in these days, where there's so little silence, so little sort of quietness in our world, where we're never without distraction. There's always something to read or to comment on. There's a noise, if you like, all constantly in our world. So, Justin, I wonder, does this signal the end of silence and therefore also the end of self-reflection? What do you think?
Well, I will say that I think life online is very loud, basically. And while it's not physically loud, like all you might hear is like the keyboards just, you know, when people type furiously away. But if you think about all the liking, all the commenting, all the trolling, all that kind of stuff, I'd say it's quite psychologically deafening, really. And I wonder if our urge to always comment on and talk into what we see in front of us means that we don't have that time to take out and to think about the bigger questions of life that do come up, but that now we can really distract ourselves from ever going near.
We talked to some people out on the streets to ask them whether they ever have time to sit quietly and to think about their lives. This is what they had to say.
Renovating. that's my hobby.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I renovate my house. Yeah. So I think about that. So that's kind of meditative. To think about how things are done.
I have 2 seconds, I'll look on my phone and I'll check Facebook.
Are you looking to Facebook just to fill the gap in
a
way?
Oh, definitely.
Thinking about those that have made choices that, you know, particularly parents or good friends that have helped you along the way.
I find sitting still really difficult. It's not one of my strong suits. I think most of my friends can attest to that. Whenever I sit down, I kind of feel like I'm wasting time or like I should be doing something else.
I guess I try to, like when I eat my breakfast in the morning, sometimes I'll go to the back veranda and just like that's my little downtime. I'm really lucky I live in a really beautiful place like where it looks over a river. And so I try and make it a positive thing and like try and think about the things that I'm like grateful for. But I don't know, worries tend to go in there as well.
I think about what I've done in my life. I think about what am I doing with my life right now. I think about where I want to be in 5 years' time. I don't know the answer to that. I think about how lucky I am to have beautiful friends and family and to live in a free country. And I can go and sit on a rock and look at that beautiful harbour of ours. And I sometimes go and sit in the church. I'm an agnostic, you know, but it's a place of peace and quiet and beauty.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder about my place in the world and who I am and who I want to be. It definitely forms quite a large part of what I think about in those me time.
Well, there's some interesting responses there, Justine. And on the whole, people seem to talk about lacking time to sit and to think about these bigger questions of life. People are tending to reach for their gadgets all the time. I find myself doing this, I have to admit. And it's something I'm trying to resist and I'm sort of failing at. And I've said to myself now that on a Sunday, it's like a Sabbath from technology, I will not press the button on my phone that tells me, you know, emails come in, I'll check those. I've just decided I'm not going to do that. And I have to actually physically resist doing it. So it's not an easy thing, even if you're sort of vaguely conscious of it.
If you talk to anyone who's under 30, I think, you know, it's already gone for them. They're going to be compulsively always reaching for their gadgets and not being able to actually stop themselves.
I mean, it's hilarious at the bus stop. If you're ever at the bus stop with lots of people, as you get onto the bus, you look around, there's almost no one that isn't on a phone there. Everyone's all on it, and I include myself in this. And in some ways, it's something I feel like at least at some level I need to resist. Now, this sort of compulsive attachment to gadgets concerns the British philosopher and theologian Peter Vardy. Now, Justin, you might remember we had him in at Centre for Public Christianity for an interview. He was so concerned about this that he made it part of the curriculum that he, program that he developed for schools in Australia and the UK and New Zealand. This is a religious and values education program that's picked up by lots of schools. And he builds into this silence and stillness as one of the strands of activity that need to be sort of focused on. Let's hear what Peter Vardy had to say about silence.
I also think more and more young people don't want to be still and look at those important questions. So they surround themselves with noise, with the iPod, with the television, with Facebook. And it can be an excuse for reflecting. I mean, let me take somebody out into the bush. And there are so many opportunities in Australia to be still as the night is falling or in dawn or to spend a night out in the bush. The whole order of what really matters begins to be reappraised. I think we've got a lot of young people growing up who never experienced that.
Well, we're talking about silence today, and that was Peter Vardy, who's developed a program of religious and values education. He's built into it a strand that involves stillness and silence and reflection. And
it's one particularly also in wilderness areas as well, which I think is really important.
What's going on with that? Do you need to be out in the bush for this to occur?
Well,
do you have value?
It is true that there is a massive tradition that goes back a long, long time where you've got people who are seeking out a spiritual experience or having a spiritual experience, but away from society. You know, they've actually retreated into the wilderness. So there is this sense somehow that natural settings actually nourish us. And we have the, you know, there are the desert Christians, but you've also got monks and holy men, I suppose, from different parts of the world who also go to nature in order to retreat. And so we have this idea of sacred spaces being apart from society. And I think that's because, you know, if we go out to a wilderness area, it's often not really welcoming for human habitation. So it's like, you know, you really have to survive and to try really hard to exist out there. And that confrontation that humans have with this vast kind of open space, it really forces them into a confrontation of, oh, I'm not that significant after all. There's this big, massive world out there. And I think it does lead people to an experience of God or an experience of the sacred, something much larger than themselves.
It reminds me of going out into the country, as I've done sometimes. We're all city slickers here, right? But if you go away from the city and spend the night out under the stars, you realise you actually can see the stars, and it's unbelievable sight if you ever do that. And it's rare that we get to do those sorts of things.
Yeah, well, it's just what Vardy said as well, that if you spend a night out in the bush and you just have that experience, then the whole order of what is important, you know, you're forced to just reconsider that to see if you think that's true.
It reminds me a bit of the desert. You mentioned the desert fathers, these sort of early centuries of Christianity where people have went into the desert to get away from the distractions that they saw were getting in between them and God. There was this famous guy, Simon, I think it's Stylitus, you pronounce it. 37 years he lived on a pole in the desert. Not sure what was going on there, but and that sounds odd to us. But nonetheless, he's very committed to this sense of ridding themselves of a distraction. But not many of us are going to live like that, Justine.
No. I think we like living in our distracted lives, basically. But, you know, there are a whole bunch of people, desert Christians and so on, who really found that they were nourished by that experience. I've been reading the work of this Russian Orthodox writer called Catherine de Houek Doherty, and she's talking about this experience of, excuse my bad Russian, the pustinia. It actually, this word means desert. And it actually refers to a practice of, you know, intentional contemplation and quiet in a lonely place. And the idea is that you'd go into some sort of room or a cabin and all there is like, you know, your bed, meager provisions, so you've got water perhaps and a loaf of bread, and then you might have a book. And for her, she's talking about having the Bible there so she can actually just go into this pustinia and sit and read the Bible and reflect and think about God and think about what he would like her to do. And this is it's an intentional kind of hermit sort of experience.
Sounds, I have to say, it sounds, Justine, to me a bit Spartan to me. It doesn't grab me so much.
No, I can. I think that's true of myself as well. But I have been challenged when I've been reading this because she has been saying stuff like how people in this tradition have felt very convicted that, if they were to steal their bodies, then their souls could go wandering, you know, to put it in those terms. So even though it may be very, you know, like unwelcoming for life, basically, they really felt nourished by it in a way that, you know, perhaps we've lost today.
I think, isn't it true also that silence is a bit confronting? We're a bit uncomfortable with silence. I think that's even true now in churches, where the room for silence in the way things are done, which I think in previous generations would have been there, you almost never get it. And I think it's part of this thing where you're so used to noise, when it's not there, we get very fidgety and uncomfortable.
I think that's absolutely right. And Gordon Hempton, to return to him, he says that silence is not the absence of something, but the presence of everything. And that sounds a little bit wishy-washy, but I think what he's saying is that we shouldn't think about silence as emptiness. You know, it is full. It is full of the world, basically, around us. And Gerald Manley Hopkins, who was a Jesuit priest, he was, you know, driven to exultation over spotting the fingerprints of God everywhere, particularly in the silence. And he says in one of his poems, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. Mm. And that would be in the noise as well as in all the silence as well. Perhaps the presence of everything, and particularly the presence of God, is what those desert Christians and what those ascetics who sought wilderness spaces, perhaps this is what they were after. And, you know, in that silence, I think it's fair to say that they had an experience where they walked and talked with God, and it really enriched them.
So this pustini, I'll trust your pronunciation on that, seems to rely on wilderness areas, but maybe then you don't need to head to the mountain retreat necessarily in order to find this sort of peace and connection.
I think a lot of us aren't able to just take off on a mountain retreat and, you know, take a vow of silence for 10 days. You know, we've got a lot of other things to do as well. But, you know, I heard a couple of weeks ago on the radio that they're now going to make some carriages or maybe some trains, you know, as a whole, silent. So you are to, when you go on there, you have to actually mute your mobile phone. You can't talk on it. If you're listening to music through your headphones, you have to have it down enough so people next to you aren't going to be bothered by that feedback as well. So, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Yeah, well, I catch a bus to work into the city every day, and I have to say I value the time because it's quiet. You're not on a school kids bus, which is always noisy, right? But on these buses, people generally just sit quietly, and it is a real opportunity, one of the rare opportunities, to sit in silence, look out the window, read, maybe read your Bible, pray, if that's the sort of thing you do. And so, yeah, maybe there's a sense of having to grab those sorts of opportunities in our busy lives when we can, and to develop that sort of sense of the importance of silence.
And that reminds me of what Gordon Hempton says. He says that when we feel secure in a silent space, we can actually open up and truly listen. And then he says, and when we're truly listening, we also have to anticipate that we become changed by what we've heard. So there's this sense that, you know, in the silence, there's actually something to listen to, even though you might not think there's anything there.
But it would seem to matter to me what it is we're listening to. Is that not the case?
The biggest difference that I've been able to, like, tell between silent contemplation as the Desert Fathers practiced it and the kind of contemplation that we practice now, you know, maybe we go to a contemporary meditation retreat, right, is that in those silent moments, we probably tend to listen to ourselves think, you know, we just tune into that inner murmur that's always going on. Am I happy in my life? Would I be better off doing this? You know, et cetera, et cetera.
Is Manly going to win the premiership?
That's not what I would be thinking about, but anyway. So my point is that it's a really far cry from those early traditions of desert prayer, because they were really keen on silencing the ego and almost being indifferent to the self so that they could be filled by God. Whereas I think all of us today, it's this constant, you know, me, 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 all throughout our head. So I think there's a really big difference there. But Catherine de Houek Doherty, she writes this: when we speak of ourselves and are filled with ourselves, we leave silence behind. So her idea is that we have to develop this, you know, pustinia of the heart. So in some ways, the individual is always carrying within them a secret silence that can nurture them. And, you know, especially now in this age of endless distraction, she says that we probably need this more than the hermits of old who didn't have as many distractions.
Yeah, that seems to make sense to me too. And that idea of getting away from yourself or beyond yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to cultivate these moments in our lives, silence, or at least a place to shut out the noise in life and to listen. We would say perhaps to listen to God, right?
Yeah, Absolutely. I mean, Gordon Hempton says that when we let silence exist, it feeds our soul. But it seems to me that the Bible has something to say that relates to that, but also goes further than that. Because in the Bible, the psalmist says, "Be still and know that I am God." And I think that is really nourishing, and that's going to feed your soul as much as, if not more, than silence.
That seems a really good place to end. Be still and know that I'm God. It's a great discussion, Justin. Good to talk to you about silence. Thanks for that. See you next time.